From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour goes back to 2009. Now, you might have seen plenty of TED Talks online, and it's been exciting to watch the development of the TEDx Rochester series. The newest edition is coming your way on this Saturday at 9 a.m., and we regret to inform you that the registrations are closed. Maybe you can find a way to crash the party. I don't know, but this hour, we are thrilled to have a long list of some of the speakers who are going to be giving you a taste of what's coming to TEDx Rochester this year. And again, you go back to 2009, and the model is the TED Talks. So we're going to hear a clip of one of my favorite TED Talks that helps give me inspiration for what I love so much about TED. But I want to start by bringing in not TED, but Tony. Tony Caracasian is the mastermind behind TEDx Rochester. And Tony, first of all, thank you for being here and rounding up all these people for us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
2009, the first
mastermind.
five years, sixth edition coming up, right?
Correct.
And the fact that you've already closed registration means you're doing just fine.
Yes, we are. We're just under about 700 attendees for this year, so we're going to be filling up East High School pretty well. They got 900 seats, so we tried to get as close as possible.
Wow, that's outstanding. Now, for you, take me back to the start of this, why you wanted to create TEDx Rochester, and what about TED that you love?
Well, I love I'm an IT guy, so I do a lot of open source stuff as well. So the idea of open sourcing ideas and sharing them with the world to make it a better place has just been it was just an easy connection for me, so I became a fan of TED very quickly. The first video I saw was Jill Bolte Taylor's talk about the stroke of insight, which I think is always the number one or number two video out there. And then a few years ago, it was actually my first daughter's first birthday, they sent out the email announcing this TEDx program. I had already decided that the world wasn't good enough for her and was going to need a change, and I was looking for a way to do that. So when this came out, I took it as a sign. I left the birthday party. I filled out the application, one of the first people in the world to fill out the application. So we were actually one of the oldest events. I figured they would give it to somebody else who knew what they were doing, and they made a mistake and gave it to me. And somehow I've managed to pull together a great group of people over the last couple of years and put on a great event.
I want to play a clip from one of my favorites, and you mentioned, do you have a favorite TED Talk? Because our listeners love hearing ideas for cool talks.
Still going to go with Jill Bolte as one of my top favorites. I actually just saw a great one at TEDx Chemung River last weekend. It was a fellow doing augmented reality and magic. I don't remember his name. I keep telling Ted that they got to put the name of the speaker at the end of the video so that.
That was a TEDx talk you're talking about there.
It was a TED video that they showed at Chemung River. We all the upstate New York folks work together on the TEDx events, Flower City and Alexandria Columbia School here as well.
How many TEDxs are there around the country now?
I think this year they're scheduled to have 3,000. We've passed over 11,000 so far since the inception of the program, all over the world. I think every country in the world has been represented. TEDx Baghdad actually just was a couple of months ago. I think the theme was hope and moving forward,
TEDx,
which is pretty impressive.
Baghdad. That would be an awesome idea.
Right?
And I bet you we could look it up online and find some. Often you can find some of the videos and the presentations.
You always should be. I know a couple of them have had bad video, but for the most part, we put all of our videos up. Every year, so you get to see all the speakers. It's a great opportunity for the speakers. They end up with a what they call a 10 to 15 minute commercial for what they do, and it's helped a lot of people move forward.
Well, and what I love is it is a commercial, but it is not just a commercial. I mean, it's not someone just pitching a product or an idea or a service. It's something with community and sort of this intrinsic value, and we're going to be getting into that with our many panelists this hour. For me, I was actually just talking to my father about a couple of TED Talks. Sir Ken Robinson, I think, has the most watched on how schools kill creativity. If you haven't watched Sir Ken Robinson on how schools kill creativity, do it today. For me, my other favorite is Benjamin Zander. Benjamin Zander is a Brit who is with the Boston Philharmonic, and he does youth orchestra. And he gave a TED Talk about the value of classical music, but he gave it in this beautiful, beautiful way where he said essentially the reason that kids grow bored with classical music is they kind of just sit there with, these are his words, both butt cheeks planted on the piano and just buh, 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 and there's nothing really exciting.
Yep.
So he teaches kids that you've got to play the piano with one butt cheek, that you've got to be able to move with it, move with the music. And after he gave this description, this is how Benjamin Zander described the impact of the one cheek movement.
You know, a gentleman was once watching a presentation I was doing, and I was working with a young pianist. He was the president of a corporation in Ohio. And I was working with this young pianist, and I said, the trouble with you is you're a two-buttock player. You should be a one-buttock player. And I moved his body like that while he was playing. Suddenly the music took off. Took flight. There was a gasp in the audience when they heard the difference. And then I got a letter from this gentleman. He said, I was so moved, I went back and I transformed my entire company into a one-buttock company.
That is just a clip of some of the best 18 minutes you'll ever see on TED. I can't recommend it enough. But Tony, that's what's amazing to me is my father in Cleveland is always sending me clips. And it's amazing.
So is my
how,
mother.
But it's amazing now how TED is doing amazing things, but it's always neat to see when someone mails you a TED, but it's actually a TEDx. And that's starting to become more common. Are you seeing that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I know that they review every video that goes up, even more so now. They've got their own staff to do just that. And a lot of times they do end up there, so no pressure to everybody, but, you know, 100 million eyes, potentially.
How do you choose? Because my guess is 5 years ago, it was a different – I mean – anything that it's in its nascent stage is not going to spark the same interest in terms of participants. How do you choose
Absolutely.
Now?
So yeah, the first year, I tell everybody I met maybe 1 in 100 people who knew what TED was at that time. And it gets very discouraging, but the way I looked at it was I introduced 99 new people to TED, so we move forward that way. We got very fortunate. We got a lot of very early response on speakers. And then, you know, it's just grown from there as to how we choose. Our main focus has always been you have to either be from Rochester or of major impact here, because other events fly in speakers from all over the country or around the world. And I understand the value of bringing in outside opinions, but there's still a lot of opinions here in Rochester that haven't been heard yet. And that's one of our main focuses, to showcase what we bring to the world stage, but also – you know, most of the people who've been involved with the event are transplants. And when you talk with the natives, they see cold and crime. And the transplants see this vibrant, creative community that we have here. So our secondary mission is to showcase to Rochesterians what Rochester's all about and show that it's not all cold and crime and crumbling infrastructure and everything else. We have some great people here doing a lot of really good work.
How many times do you have to say no?
Oh, so many more times than I want. I would say so. To give an example, last year when I was still doing the speaker interviews, I met with, I think, 78 people, and we ended up with 16. So that was just 1 year. So that's fairly typical.
And so there must be some very talented people you have to turn down.
There are, and that's always saddening, especially this year. This is my last year doing it. I decided that this would be my last year organizing it. So I still get people showing up. They're like, hey, how about next year? I'm like, well, nobody's really stepped up to take the license yet. So
really? Okay.
Yeah, surprisingly. I actually have one person who's interested, so hopefully he's going to follow through with that. But, you know, we still have TEDx Flower City and Allendale Columbia School, so I'll often pass off great speakers that I thought were awesome, but we just didn't fit the theme for that year, pass them off to one of the other events, and I know at least one or two people have moved over to them It's I don't want their story to be lost.
Yeah. TEDx Rochester, you can find online. They give you the rundown of the speakers. They give you the past years, which is nice. You can see some videos. What's the website, Tony?
TEDxRochester.org.
TEDxRochester.org. Why don't you introduce the man to your left? That's Dan Lill.
Absolutely.
And before I grill Dan a little bit about what he's going to be talking about, tell me how you alighted upon Dan for TEDx Rochester.
Dan's organization, Our Community Bikes, has been recommended numerous times. We've always had something bike-related for the city, and it's always been, how can we be more bike-friendly? And we finally got to the community portion of our event. This year, it's all about community, and it just seemed a perfect fit for what they do every year. And I think it was about 5 minutes into your interview that everybody decided that, well, he's in. I mean, that was an easy one.
Well, now, Dan, after all of that buildup and hearing how many people get turned down, this better be the best interview of my life. No, that must make you feel really remarkable.
Boy, I thought I was setting him up.
I have never heard those numbers before, and they're a little bit scary, and makes me want to go home and prepare a little bit more than I am. It is absolutely wonderful to be part of this group. We look forward to Saturday, to speaking about what we do at Our Community Bikes, and the fact that the theme is community, and the middle word of our name is community. That's really what we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about not only the recipients that get our bicycles, and we give away a lot of bicycles every year, and we repair a lot of bicycles every year. So we know that we have an effect on the people that we give the bikes to. We'll be talking about that, but also on the effect that we have on the volunteers and the donors in the community as well. When they come into the shop and see what's going on and what's happening and the variety of activities that are happening, I think we're the fact that we have community in our name and community as part of TED is very appropriate. We're really looking forward to it.
Community, real quick, for those of you who are attending and listening, we're actually having a bike drive for our community bikes. They'll have their trailer there to collect any bikes, bikes parked, bikes equipment, no helmets, please. Did I get the whole paragraph right?
tricycles
as well. Yeah. See, I knew I missed something. So they'll have their trailer there, and also DeCarlos Rental has donated a truck to help. Hopefully, we'll have too many for their trailer, and we'll have to use the 16-foot box truck. But yeah, so, and if you're not a donor, still drop off. We're at East High Saturday all day. Drop off a bike.
When it comes to the results of what you do, are you going to share? And I'm sure you've seen some really, really neat personal stories, people impacted.
Every day. Absolutely every day we see the impact of what we do. And most of the time it's unanticipated. I was talking to somebody yesterday who wanted me to share our philosophy at our community bikes. And I said, we don't have a philosophy. We just meet the needs of the community wherever we see them. And we kind of go with the flow. This thing developed pretty much on its own. I don't want to say totally on its own because that'll infuriate our volunteers. but we're there to meet the needs of the community. And we're meeting the needs not only in the area of transportation, but in a lot of other areas. And that's what we'll be talking about as well.
When you say meet the needs as they arise, again, obviously transportation, but give me an example.
Without revealing something that I'm going to be talking about, we have a number of volunteers that come to us court-appointed, for example. And they can be young or they can be older. They can be court-appointed for a number of reasons. But it seems as though when they get into an environment where they're interacting with other people who are very positive about contributing to the community, it changes them. And we've seen some pretty dramatic changes in some folks in fairly short amounts of time, too. So it kind of points to the fact that inherent in almost all of us, there's something good and all. It just needs to come out some way. And we've been able to, for whatever reason, foster that with a lot of people.
He seems like the kind of person, Tony, who is sort of relentlessly looking for the positive.
Yeah, he gets like that sometimes. No, I mean that was what, 5 minutes? And see, you're already sold on him. But see how easy that was? And you don't even know what he's talking about.
I don't. I have no idea. It could be anything. I'd be there. Dan, how long is your presentation? Do you know? I'm sure you know.
It's about 10 minutes.
About 10 minutes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because it's, is it still 18 minutes or less as the model, Tony, or is it even tighter for TEDx?
We shoot for 18 minutes or less, but this year I think we're topped at 12.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we tried last year just doing all 12-minute talks because you'd sometimes get people, why do they get more time than me? Well, he's got to explain stem cell research before he can start talking about his idea.
Right.
You're organizing a community thing. Everybody knows what community is. So, but yeah, this year they're pretty close in times, though.
Was your first draft like 25 minutes and now it's 10? Was it difficult to get to 10?
No, not really. I think I may have to stop in mid-sentence in order to get to 10, though.
Cut yourself off. The music plays in the back. And thank you very much. Thank the agent. No, that's. Are you ready to go, Dan?
I absolutely am. Yeah. I think it's going to be a wonderful opportunity, and not only for our community bikes, but all these other organizations too. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm a real big fan of TED, and I have to thank my daughter for that. She turned me on to it several years ago, and now if you can be addicted to the computer in a good way, that's what I am.
Let me just get to a question from Twitter. Mark asking if there's going to be a way to watch live. I don't think we watch live, but will you be able to watch the videos Tony?
No, last year we did a live stream because we were at the Planetarium and only had 200 seats. This year we weren't able to arrange that for the event. So
no,
we just decided
stream.
With more seats would be the solution.
900 seats filled. No live stream on Saturday for TEDx Rochester, but will you be able to see subsequently in subsequent weeks, will you be able to see the videos
yes.
from this year?
Yeah. Okay. We'll get them out as quick as possible. Okay. It's usually a month or two because we're going right into the holiday season. So.
Okay. And again, Mark online, the website, Tony, for
TEDxRochester.org.
So check TEDxRochester.org in the coming weeks, and you're getting a taste for some of that, so you'll be able to see Dan and see what he does say, what he didn't reveal on this program. So let me introduce, or I'll let Tony introduce the, or at least explain how he brought in Shana Gimanis and Don Vogler Ellis.
Tell us. Oh, see, that. I thought he was doing it just so he didn't have to try to pronounce your name again.
No, I stuck the landing there, did
you
I not?
You did really
Shana?
Well.
You did well. You
Shana
did well.
Gimanis.
Yes, thank you.
Don Vogler Ellis.
Elias.
Oh, my.
We can't take him anywhere.
My note says Ellis. I was working so hard on Shana's last name. It does say Elias. It's like, you know how you get the hard thing down and then you miss the easy one? Anyway, Don, Shana, nice to have you. Tony, tell us a little bit about them.
Well, both instructors from Nazareth College in the autism degree master's program. They brought a unique twist to the idea of the master's program, I thought. For me, one of the biggest, the easy sells for me was they immediately mentioned Jenny McCarthy and the devastating effect she's had on the community. But beyond that, the stories that she tells, they tell about the individuals that they work with, was really what struck home for us. The great story about the ketchup, I don't think you threw that one into your talk, but that one I still tell everybody because I think it's a
Does
great
that mean
story.
We're allowed to tell it now because it's not going to be in the talk on Saturday?
Yeah, probably.
Shana, can we tell it?
It's up to you.
I can use a variation of it. There is a variation of that story in the talk, but we won't give too much away
okay,
if we share
ahead.
That.
We'd love to hear it.
Well, so Don and I are co-directors of the Interdisciplinary Specialty Program in Autism at Nazareth, which is an effort between multiple disciplines, which is why we are very excited about this. We think it's a very special project, but we realize that we may be the only ones who feel that way. But thankfully, Tony thought
close.
So as well. And so this brings in professionals from so many different areas. So it's not just education, which is my background. It's not just speech-language pathology, which is Dawn's background. But we have folks that are in music education, music therapy, occupational therapy, social work, just across so many different groups that are interested in learning more about autism. And so, you know, that really is the focus of our program and transforming perceptions of autism. And so that's really what our talk is centered around, is transforming that perception that we commonly see. The story about the ketchup, or actually it was spaghetti sauce, when I was working as a consultant, I was working with a family, and when the mother said that she was very frustrated because her 16-year-old son wouldn't eat spaghetti without it being made out of the ragu sauce, and he would spend every night dumping that sauce on the floor and breaking the glass bottle. And so I very much, in my consultant way, suggested that she go buy spaghetti sauce in a plastic jar. And when she looked at me, I thought she was going to jump on the table and put her hands around my neck. And she said, "You don't think I've thought of that? He won't eat spaghetti out of a plastic jar." So I learned my lesson.
Let me ask Dawn then. Shana mentions perceptions, the changing perceptions of autism. And so many of my wife and I's own friends have children with autism. Mm-hmm. And I know that the rates of diagnosis, is it 1 in 68 now? Or it's really remarkable to see, because it felt like it wasn't long ago that it was 1 in 100, then 1 in 88, and 1 in 68. Are we seeing a change in perception, expectation, especially in the way schools handle it, in the way that kids are able to grow up? And some of the difficulties that schools have had, are those things improving?
I think, you know, there is improvement. And one thing that Shana and I really focus on, because we're working on future professionals. So we're working with people who are going to be educators, going to be speech language pathologists.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to sort of shift the way that we maybe historically have thought about educating students who have various needs. And we're trying to encourage professionals to listen to families, listen to the voices of people with autism, adults with autism who are now telling us about maybe some interventions that are evidence-based. There's a lot of evidence for them, but adults with autism are saying, you know what, I didn't really feel good when I was treated that way, or I didn't feel good about, you know, how I was taught my colors in that manner. So we're trying to help professionals, you know, absolutely, we need to look at the evidence. We need to analyze the evidence. We need to know, you know, what is research and scientifically based, but we also need to think about the culture, our, you know, cultural expectations, the lived experience of families, lived experience of individuals with autism when we're thinking about and deciding on interventions with those individuals as opposed to for those individuals.
Do the comments from people like Jerry Seinfeld help or hurt? And I ask because Jerry Seinfeld...
Yeah, we've been having a lot of dialogue about this.
If you missed the long and the short of it, Jerry Seinfeld said that he thinks it's possible that he is on the autism spectrum for a number of reasons. And did you want to just sum up sort of what he said and what you think?
Yeah, I mean, he basically... the term self-diagnosis is used a lot in the autism community. There are many adults who did not get a formal diagnosis of autism as children, and they now are able to sort of understand the criteria and feel that they fit that criteria. And he he's done some reading and feels like maybe he might fall somewhere on the autism spectrum. And so there's been some dialogue in the community. Some people have embraced the fact that he has come out and said that, saying, wow, what a wonderful example for our community of someone who's successful and, you know, admired by many, intelligent, funny, witty, like that's great. Other people, you know, there have been some families and who have said, you know, How dare he say that he has autism? That, you know, how can someone who has abstract humor have autism, and are kind of feeling, you know, not as embracing it so much? I think it depends how you look at it.
But you don't think that he did it in a way that was tongue-in-cheek or for a joke, do you?
No.
I did not think
we've
that.
We've seen a lot of articles written, too, in defense of what he did.
I've seen a strong split. Yeah, it's been very interesting.
A strong split. And to go on and say that, I mean, that's a very serious consideration that he made. And, you know, we've read some recent blogs from individuals that are on the autism spectrum who are saying, who are we to say that he isn't having social difficulties, or that that wasn't really challenging for him to do the things that he did? And so how can we make this judgment that autism only fits inside this one little box, and if that's the characteristics that you have, then all of a sudden you have autism? You know, he represents a different way of considering autism that many individuals who are on the autism spectrum feel that they also embrace that. So it is kind of how you look at it. Most of the debate was really, most individuals on the autism spectrum did seem to embrace his self-diagnosis.
We're talking to Shana Germanis and Don Vogler-Elias, who are going to be speaking at TEDx Rochester on this coming Saturday. If you're just joining us, it's the sixth TEDx Rochester, and unfortunately it is all booked up. It's registered, filled up, and that's really remarkable, because they're in a big auditorium and they're going to have a great event, but you will be able to see some of these presentations by a video at the TEDx Rochester site in the coming months as they pull together these professionals and these people from around our community on various issues. So, Shana, a brief taste of what you guys are going to be talking about without giving away too much of the presentation.
Well, our talk is Transforming Perceptions of Autism, and so we will be presenting a story of a young man that is on the autism spectrum and inviting the audience to explore different perspectives and ways of thinking about his behaviors, the way in which he speaks, the way in which he interacts with others, and asking the community that will be present there to consider it and think about it maybe in different ways, looking at strengths in particular.
Don, are we moving in a direction where, again, we've seen the rate of diagnosis of autism now 1 in 68? Is it going to continue to change and to become more prevalent as we understand it more, do you think?
I don't know. I don't know if I can speak to, you know, what will happen with the prevalence rate, but I do think that there is increased awareness and increased understanding of what it means to have autism, and, you know, hopefully increased understanding of how we can support individuals with autism.
I have to think also for parents that it can be, it's challenging. In every case and every person is different. It can be scary. But I also have to think that there is a comfort in knowing, a comfort in diagnosing, because what the work that you both are doing and training professionals to help people is going to only make the community stronger when we recognize the differences and learn to sort of incorporate and integrate, and instead of seeing that struggle with certain behaviors or certain barriers put up. What do you think, Shana?
I think that the family experience is, what we do know is the families are experiencing autism very differently. And so a big part of our coursework is we actually link all of our participants with a family to go and have a family experience with them. So they actually spend about 3 visits with the family doing something that is not professionally related. So they might have dinner, they might go watch a bedtime routine, they might go to the zoo with the family, and really kind of deeply understand that family experience. Some families are very relieved that they know what's happening, mm-hmm. and there's a name for it. Other families are very devastated by the diagnosis. And, you know, our job, we really work hard with our participants to not judge families one way or the other, but rather to work with them where they are at. So I do think that families are experiencing it differently. And also, it does depend on sometimes how easily their child is able to move through some of those barriers. And for some families, that's a little bit harder for those children to do. The barriers are, there are more of them.
And Dawn, well, maybe let me wrap with this. Maybe as we see more and better diagnosis, and maybe just in general, whether it's in elementary schools or high schools or in the professional world or in our own communities, if we all are improving at sort of embracing the differences, et cetera, maybe the family that gets the diagnosis this year and next year and 5 years and 10 years from now will see the success stories and see the breakthroughs and the improvements. And I understand that it can be frightening, but maybe this kind of work can help everyone feel like that there is progress and there is hope and that there are ways to adapt.
I think absolutely. I think, you know, a lot of comfort comes from connections. And so I think the more that we know about autism, families are able to connect with other families who have a child with autism. They see a celebrity or someone they know who they perceive as successful who has autism. It just increases our stories and our understanding of what autism is. And we don't have these, you know, single images, these negative images that we sometimes, you know, maybe exposed to.
Tony, this is a very serious question. Did they really mention Jenny McCarthy?
They did. Well, I think one of my team probably brought it up. But,
okay.
It's funny you talk about the way you describe changing perspectives. Shana and Dawn's talk was actually the one that actually helped finalize our idea for our theme this year in terms of community.
Did you know that, Dawn?
No. See? Why?
It was really about utilizing underleveraged members of our society. You know, there was a couple other talks that just all kind of fit in, and it just made sense at that point. So we'll probably talk more about the theme when April sits down, because she's actually the one who came up with the actual theme. But it was very, very positive. You guys had a big influence on our theme this year. So.
Well, look, we just broke a little news for you there. Yeah. Congratulations, and certainly looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Thanks for coming
thank
in and
you
sharing
very
your
much.
Perspective.
Yes, thank you.
Let's take a 60-second break. When we come back, we're going to meet more of the presenters. TEDx Rochester Saturday. It is sold out, even though it's free. It is registered out, but you'll be able to see it online in the months to come. Tony Caracasian, the man behind it, is with us, and more of the presenters when we come back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, we examine child care subsidies in Rochester. What have the recent elections meant for help for families in need, help for children? What programs are available? How are the pre-K services going? We talk to the experts who've been analyzing the data and the policy to find out what is going on with child care in the Rochester and Western New York community. All coming up Thursday on Connections.
It did happen again. This weekend, 2 miners were killed in a blast.
Many mines continue operating despite safety violations and without paying a total of $70 million in fines.
I mean, I know the Bible says vengeance is God's, he will repay, but you think, why are they not being punished?
NPR investigates today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4.
Dan Little didn't know we were going to be back on the air. I'm just going to let him keep praising the show. Dan was packing up, and if you missed him talking earlier this hour, you can, again, you'll see more of him at TEDx Rochester on Saturday. But it's just a really interesting, diverse group of presenters. Tony Caracasian's here. And let's talk to Matt Spall. Tony?
Sure enough. So big fan of this next fellow's mother. She's been a big supporter of ours for the last few years. I met her at the first TEDx event, and we sat and chat for like 10, 15 minutes. Every time I run into her, she's always a ball of energy that I love hanging out with. But she was actually tapped as a potential speaker for this year for the Center of Youth. But my mom comes up every year, so she's very proud of me. She's very proud of her son as well. And she told me a little bit about the work that he's been doing as part of the Center for Youth, specifically as a filmmaker. And it just blew us away. And we said, all right, we can't have you, Elaine. Sorry, we got to go with Matt.
So, Matt, your background, and I want to talk about that in a moment, because your background takes you through the ESPNs of the world and working with people really all over the place. But but the focus on Saturday is, again, without giving too much away, what specifically?
Well, it's really a focus on a film I made over the summer with seven young men from the Center for Youth. And a little bit of a different film than I've ever made, and really films out there. And I gave the cameras to them. I gave the cameras to the kids. So the filmmakers were also the subjects. And I think they're a group that a lot of people talk about, and a lot of things are said about what they need, the struggles they face. And instead of doing maybe another film or another situation where I'm talking about that, I wanted to hear what their challenges were on a daily basis. And also, you know, some of the really great things that they're accomplishing. It's not all bad. And just, you know, how great they can be. And so that's a little bit of what I'm talking about.
When you give them a camera,
yeah,
how does it change the final product and our experience of learning about them?
Well, I think the first thing is they don't have any formal background training. So you see camera angles, you see a rawness to the footage that really actually lends itself to believability and the understanding that this is the truth, this is the reality that they face. And, you know, we have all sorts of dolly moves and jib arms and things that we can do in filmmaking to make beautiful shots. But I think that there's a raw nature to this film that really captivates an audience and also expresses their challenges that they face.
How old are they?
They range from 16 to 21.
Okay. And give me a sense for when you gave them the camera and how long they were doing that.
Yeah, we were together for about 5 months total. Okay. It was a summer job, so we were able to receive funding from AT&T to actually pay them a small stipend during that process. And it was just a great experience for everyone involved, and that's kind of where my talk is going. I'm actually going to show about 8 minutes of the film.
Matt Spall is here, and Elaine Spall's been on this program just recently. In fact, Fashion Week, talking about the Center for Youth.
That's right.
But Elaine has long been a very vocal and a big believer in giving young people a chance when the stereotypes would say, you know, they're going nowhere, or they're going worse than nowhere. That the trouble lies ahead.
Right.
How does your work help us understand our own stereotypes, but also some of the very real challenges?
Yeah, I think just them as people come across, and you don't look at them as a statistic
or a headline
or a group, but you see that they are just real people, individuals trying to make it through this world just like all of us, and just trying to see the next day, and you know, it's tough for them to focus on a future when their challenges are the needs of today. And they can't think about their future needs because they have to think about how they're going to get food in the next 2 hours.
Now let me bolster Matt's credibility and background just by asking you. PBS, ESPN,
yeah,
et cetera.
Yeah.
How do you compare working at PBS versus, say, ESPN?
Oh, man. I was lucky enough to be freelancing for ESPN, but I was living in cities for 3 or 4 months at a time and, you know, kind of acting as a one-man band, interviewing, filming, tracking progress of particular projects.
For what exactly?
For a show called Rise Up, which actually, interestingly enough, you know, it's funny how things come back to you. But this was a show that was basically extreme home makeover for high school athletic facilities at, you know, inner city schools around the country. And we did 7 episodes, and it was amazing to not only be a part of the building process and see that change within the school, but I was able to visit a lot of the kids at home. And that kind of experience really prepared me, I think, for this project that I was able to make.
Very interesting. You know, I have all kinds of issues with ESPN on a journalistic level, on a day-to-day programming level, but some of their filmmaking. Thirty for thirties.
Yep.
Really remarkable stuff.
Yeah, and that's where this was.
Right.
Living.
Right. So, did you feel a freedom? I mean, did they give you a lot of room to tell stories?
They did. They had.
That was a very careful yes.
Very qualified.
You know, they have to hit certain points. You have an hour to tell a story.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they have to make sure to hit points. And we had two hosts, Chris Spielman being one of them. And so I always felt that I wanted more of the kids that I had talked to and interviewed. And I had, you know, hours and hours, hundreds of hours of footage of them. And maybe they ended up in, you know, 10 minutes of that piece because they have to touch on so many other things. But it was still a great experience. And to see those kids change even over that course of time was an amazing thing for me.
Now, tomorrow, I will be hosting a live event at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center with Michael Kirk of Frontline. And we had an interesting conversation on this program last week where he told me that some of the news magazine, documentary-style filmmaking, 60 Minutes, for example, mm-hmm. they are more let me actually make sure that I'm not going to misquote Michael Kirk. He's simply observing that they are more likely to have a Steve Croft or a Leslie Stahl on camera. It's kind of the star
yep.
of a report.
Yep.
Whereas Frontline, you rarely see Michael Kirk himself or the reporter, people they're working with, because the subject is the story, the subject is the star. And he's not maligning 60 Minutes, by the way. He's saying, look, those are journalists with great credentials. They can do it. But I'm wondering if we see too much documentary filmmaking where the on-air talent becomes the star, and does it detract from the story?
Well, I tend to believe in the frontline, you know, thinking. I think that there are certain ways to make a documentary, and sometimes subjects just call for different things, access that you may have to that subject or the lack of access. You know, they don't want to talk about certain things on camera, but for a story, you need to get it across. So I really, you know, I love 60 Minutes. I love Frontline. But I think it's more about just how they're able to tell that story. And for documentary filmmaking, the big key is access. And if you have access to those people, if they're willing to open up to you, then you can really use them as the stars and, you know, use them as the subject. And sometimes they just, for whatever reason, are camera shy or don't want to talk about things as much as they did when they were off camera. And so it's a way to still get that across. So I don't know. I'm a fan of Frontline more. But
last question then for you, Matt, since you're obviously a very good communicator, and Tony sure. doesn't choose anybody who's not a good communicator.
Yeah.
But for you on Saturday, are you looking forward to being the person on stage that the people are listening to, and will that be different for you?
Yeah, it's going to be different for me because I'm usually behind the camera.
Right.
And I even in this project, I'm not in it ever. And one of the things that I think is an interesting part of my talk, without giving too much away, is maybe how my experience, even though it's all about the kids and the subjects, are them, I think my experience allowed me to maybe be able to share something with the creative community in terms of how we can all benefit. It's not just a one-way street. You know, I didn't just give them something by any means. They imparted so much knowledge on me.
Matt Spahl is one of the speakers at TEDx Rochester. It's Saturday at 9 a.m. at East High School, and don't try to register for tickets. Tony Caracasian's been telling us. You should have come on the show earlier. I mean, usually
I know,
we help you move
I
tickets.
Know. I actually reached out to Alyssa a few months ago. But
No, it's my fault. But look, this is, again, we keep calling this a good problem to have.
Exactly.
Which shows you how successful TEDx Rochester has been. This is number six in their 5 years since it launched, and so you, even if you're not going to go on Saturday, you'll be able to see some of the videos on the website in coming months. Let's talk to Lisa. Go
sure
ahead,
enough.
Tony.
Lisa, I actually ran into as part of the Leadership Rochester program a couple years ago. I toured, and I can't remember the name of the facility. I remember hanging out with you. I remember it was over in the 19th Ward, but it was a place for students to grow food and so forth and sell at the farm market, and I remember it specifically because I remember you had a water bottle there that was painted by Sarah Rutherford, and I went, "Hey, is that?" So she got recommended for the new project or the extension of the project, there were a number of words that really stuck out for us in the talk, like food deserts, and it was a great talk, but I just got to see your final draft, and it just blew me away how how you get all of that information into such a short, concise amount of time. I don't even know where to begin to talk with without giving too much away. So,
yeah, Lisa, now you have to try to talk and not give too much away. What's a little taste of what's coming on Saturday?
So my project is called the Seedful Project, and without giving too much away, what we really do in our work is work to provide ways for young people to engage with the food system in terms of urban gardening, cooking, thinking about food and what it really is in a bigger sense. And we provide ways for our young people to be the primary actors in all of that work. And what that really does is not only does it give our young people a chance to really think about their roles as leaders in their neighborhoods a lot differently, even just through something as simple as food. But it really also, and it also gives them the chance to think about food as something larger, to really look at what a food system means, what our current problems and challenges are within that, and how we can begin to broach that and to begin to make changes. But it also really gives the community a chance to look at young people differently in terms of what they are able to contribute.
How young?
So I've worked with kids from a really wide range of ages, but currently our work really focuses on teenagers. So we work with kids in like 14 to 18.
Teenage boys, especially, to get them to actually think about the food system. I mean, that's a tall challenge, isn't it?
It's, you know, a lot of it is meeting people where they're at. And one thing that I think that really makes our program work is that we give our kids the chance to do this from a really wide range of angles. So, you know, our kids do everything. They grow the food, they cook it, they sell it. But, you know, we have like a construction component to our project, and we had some of our teenage boys who weren't always as interested in some of the other stuff. They loved getting to help build a hydroponic bed in our greenhouse this year. You know, they got to build a walkway that connected the rest of the system. So it's sort of finding ways of engaging young people no matter where their interests lie.
Lisa, remind our listeners the name of the program again.
It's called the Seed Folk Project. So we run the Seed Folk Store, which is on West Main Street. It's a small community grocery store. And we also run the Seed Folk City Farm, which is a multi-campus urban farm here in Rochester.
You know, maybe I should ask Lisa a question that we're going to have on a future program, which is we've spent a lot of time this year on this program talking about the movement that looks at local agriculture, CSAs, understanding where your food is from, developing mm-hmm. that kind of a relationship with it. Mm-hmm. You know, I never understood why people don't care to know where their food is from. But after we had one of these programs a couple of months ago, one of our listeners emailed and said, you've got to focus on how do we try to eat fresh and local in the winter? And I think it's a good question. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if kids come to you and ask you that, when you start to talk to them about the food system, especially in Rochester in the lean times?
Yeah, that is a good question. I mean, honestly, with our kids, it starts at a way more basic level than mm-hmm, that. Mm-hmm.
That. If you get there, you've done really well.
Yeah, right? I would love it. Gosh, I would love it if that was the first question that one of our teens asked.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we get kids who don't know that food grows in the ground, you know. I mean, that's more often.
Yeah.
Not always. I mean, we have a really wide range of kids with different base experiences. But, you know, one thing that does change the way we're able to approach that is by having a greenhouse. We do have a hydroponic greenhouse where we're able to grow year round, and I think that is, you know, that's cool for the kids to see that there can be things that are. Once they've begun to understand a little bit, you know, that they can see things that are green, that are growing indoors when it's snowing outside.
Yeah, and then they don't hit a wall in the winter of, you know, sort of communicating about food and seeing it, you know.
Right.
Which is great. So what's the mission? Describe the overall mission of what you do.
So our overall mission is to not only engage young people with their food and to really provide a campus for our kids to learn about what food really means and how it spans really many different categories of community issues and broader issues, and to provide kids a way to learn by doing, So not only that, but our broader mission is really to empower young people and people of all ages, really, to be able to think more about how they can relate to food and how it can be something that can be at once more personal, but also to be something that really changes the way the community thinks about food and young people.
What did you have for dinner last night?
That's a great question. Actually, I made soup with leeks from our garden, with Swiss chard from our hydroponic greenhouse, and potatoes from one of my farmer friends.
See, I'm glad I asked.
That's great. I'm glad you asked. Thank you. I'm glad I had a good answer.
I do think at some point we'll look back. Future generations will look back with a little bit of shame over the way animals were treated. Those kind of things. And I think it will be interesting to see how fast that change happens, because I think it's happening. I think CAFOs, you know, I understand the economic impact, but I think it will be interesting to see what society finds acceptable when it comes to food.
Absolutely. Yeah.
An interesting conversation. Looking forward to Lisa's talk on Saturday at TEDx Rochester. Tony, we got one person left in the studio for you to introduce us to, and she's only the person who helped create the theme, April Bayou.
I know, right? So April and I met actually 2 years ago as a potential speaker for last year's event. She told me a little bit about her project, and I think you were just kind of underway at that point.
Just getting started.
Yeah. So I said, all right, why don't you work with us for a year? Because you're going to meet a lot of people, going to have a lot of stories to collect. And she's just been wonderful. There's a lot that couldn't have happened if it wasn't for April this year. So, have at it. It's all you.
April, what do you do?
I have a company called Story Chick, and the mission of Story Chick is to unite the community through story. So use stories to bring people closer together. And so a lot of the stuff that I did for TEDx Rochester this year involved telling the superhero backstories of all of our speakers as a way to present them to our audience. And gathering and sharing stories is really the focus of it, and using that to tie the community. So
I love the notion of it. How does it work on a day-to-day, week-to-week business for you? And tell me what your week-to-week is like then. Who are you working with?
It's more of an art project at the moment rather than a money-making business. I have specific projects that I'm running that focus the end in performances usually or in-person events. So I had shows at the past two Fringe festivals, and we'll be working with Writers and Books and some other organizations to get more performances out throughout the year and more opportunities for people to hear and experience the stories of others in the community. So looking into potential ways to publish and things like that as well.
Everybody's got a story, right?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Do you love pulling out the stories from people? I mean, it sounds to me like you're a natural storyteller.
Yeah, I mean, and it doesn't take a lot of pulling necessarily. What I like to do is just kind of give people a field and let them run and see where they take me. And most of the time, like 9.5 times out of 10, that comes out with a great story, without me having to necessarily probe a lot or, you know, tease and tweak and pull. So for the Fringe programs, for example, I just ask people to tell me a story. And it could be about anything. Some people come up and talk about deer that come into their yard, and it's the same deer that's had kids there a couple of different years. You know, but other people talk about when he was a child and learned about the death of his father. You know, so it really, really ranges. But that's one of the things that's really cool about it.
I think people love good storytelling too. And
oh yeah.
I look at my 2.5-year-old son and I tell him a story before bed every night, and some of the stories, I mean, I'm making them up on the spot. I'm trying to like weave in moral examples and things like that, and good eating habits and being nice to other people. And some of them must be objectively terribly boring. And buddy, if you're listening with mom right now, I love you, and it's probably just about nap time. So, but let me also say, he loves it. He doesn't want to go to bed without a story, and you see that at the basic level for a toddler. But I think we also have a desire to have our stories told, and sometimes I think what we're all moving too fast to realize people have these interesting stories, and that's why it's fun to see what Story Chick is about. So what's a brief little tease? How do you distill that on Saturday?
On Saturday, I'm focusing on the impact on the community, really, and what is it about stories that pulls us all together? And of course, you know, I'm a storyteller, so I have a story from my own experience, but also an illustrative fable as well.
Oh,
so that's fun. I always have to pull in some long ago and far away.
Tony, it's a really interesting lineup you've got, and
this isn't even half of it.
That's exactly right. I mean, this was everybody that we could round up on one day into one room.
Right.
So this is it for you then?
Yep. I always said five and done. But last year was a little bit of a small event, so I said, well, I'll just say 5 years and done.
Well, then I've got a minute left. Let me ask you then, what have you learned about Rochester in the last 5 years doing this?
Wow. This is a very determined to succeed town. And there's a conversation. I've been here about 20 years. There's a conversation that started in the last 5-6 years that I think is moving us towards the right direction. I think people are starting to talk to each other, and that's great to see. I'm just glad that I was able to provide the platform for a few other people to get their voices heard out there and move us forward.
Because you have probably seen some – look, every person on the stage is going to end up making an impact, having an impact, but you've probably seen some very interesting things come out of these talks, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely. Ralph Spezio a few years ago, he's our runaway star by far. His talk got out there, and he started – getting calls from state legislatures to talk about lead poisoning and what they could do and the CDC and everything. And, you know, since I've only got a couple seconds, I'm going to say here that I think WXXI has been a huge portion of our success and appreciate it, that you guys essentially validated us after our second years. You guys jumped in. You do our videography every year. And Lou Papa and Alyssa Orlando will be speaking as well.
My colleague Alyssa, who hosts Healthy Fridays and Second Opinion Live here. I'm always excited to see what Lou is going to say as well.
Absolutely.
And it's never filtered.
No, he's got some good stuff to say.
So that'll be fabulous as well. So as Tony mentioned here, you've only heard a portion of that. I hope you have registered and you'll be there on Saturday to see these. But if not, check them out in the future as they post them online. And Tony, regardless, next year when someone steps up,
right,
we'll come back and we'll talk.
And don't forget, there's still TEDx Flower City and TEDx Allendale Columbia School. So we've still got a lot of conversation going on.
Look at him spreading the love. Indeed. The lesson is you don't have to throw elbows and be competitive like that.
Absolutely.
Congratulations, everybody. Have fun Saturday. Tony, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Thank you for listening. Dave Campo, our engineer today on WXXI, WEOS, WRUR, wherever you are. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Connections on Member-Supported Public Radio.